He'll win, Doctor. He doesn't suffer from thirst. I thought Grandmother would have understood. It was hot in the airless, waterless chambers. It was hot in the room where her livid body was crushed by other livid bodies. Like me, she must have opened her mouth to drink air, to drink water. But there was no water where she was. There was no air. She was only drinking death, as you drink water or air, mouth open, eyes closed, fingers clenched. Suddenly I felt a strange need to speak out loud, to tell the story of Grandmother's life and death, to describe her black shawl that used to frighten me until I was reassured by her kind, simple expression. Grandmother was my refuge. Every time my father scolded me, she would intervene. "Fathers are like that," she'd explain smilingly. "They get angry over nothing." One day my father slapped me. I had stolen some money from the store cash register in order to give it to a classmate, a sickly, poor little boy. They called him Chaim, the orphan. I always felt ill at ease in his presence. I knew I was happier than he was, and this made me feel guilty. Guilty that my parents were alive. That's why I stole the money. But when my father asked me, trying to find out what I had done with it, I didn't tell him. After all, I couldn't tell my father that I felt guilty because he was alive. He slapped my face, and I ran to Grandmother. I could tell her the whole truth. She didn't scold me. Sitting in the middle of the room, she lifted me onto her lap and began to sob. Her tears fell on my head, which she was holding against her bosom, and I discovered, to my surprise, that a grandmother's tears are so hot that they burn everything in their path. "She's there," the doctor said. "She's outside in the hallway. Do you want her to come in?" With the strength that came from my fear, I screamed, "No, I don't, I don't." I thought he was talking about my grandmother. I didn't want to see her. I knew she had died, of thirst maybe, and I was afraid she wouldn't be as I remembered her. I was afraid she wouldn't have the black shawl on her head, nor those burning tears in her eyes, nor that clear, calm expression that could make you forget you were cold. "You should see her," the doctor said softly. "No, not now." My tears left scars on my cheeks, on my lips, on my chin. From time to time they even managed to slip under the cast. Why was I crying? I had no idea. I think it was because of Grandmother. She used to cry very often. She would cry when she was happy and also when she was unhappy. When she was neither happy nor unhappy, she would cry because she could no longer feel the things that bring about happiness and unhappiness. I wanted to prove to her that I had inherited her tears, which, as it is written, open all doors. "It's up to you," the doctor said. "Kathleen can come back tomorrow." Kathleen. What did she have to do with this? How did she meet Grandmother? Had she also died? "Kathleen," I said, letting my head fall back. "Where is she?" "Outside," the doctor said, somewhat surprised. "In the hallway." "Bring her in." The door opened, and light footsteps came toward my bed. Again I made a desperate effort to open my eyes, but my eyelids felt sewn together. "How are you, Kathleen?" I asked in a barely audible voice.
"Fine."
"You see, I am Dmitri Karamazov's most recent victim." Kathleen forced a little laugh.
"You were right, it's a bad movie."
"Better to die than to see it." Kathleen's laugh sounded false.
"You're exaggerating."
Whispers. The doctor was speaking to her very softly.
"I have to leave you," Kathleen said, sounding very sorry.
"Be careful crossing the street." She leaned over to kiss me. An old fear took hold of me. "You mustn't kiss me, Kathleen." She pulled back her head abruptly. For a moment there was silence in the room. Then I felt her hand on my forehead. I was going to tell her to take it away quickly and not to run the risk of catching fire, but she had already taken it away. Kathleen tiptoed out of the room, followed by the doctor. The nurse stayed with me. I would really have liked to know what she looked like, old or young, beautiful or sullen, blonde or brunette. But I still couldn't move my eyelids. All my efforts to open them came to nothing. At one point I told myself that willpower wasn't enough, that I had to use both my hands. But they were tied to the sides of the bed, and the big needles were still there. "I'm going to give you 2 shots," the nurse announced, in a voice from which I could guess nothing. "2? Why 2? "First penicillin, and the second to help you fall asleep." "You don't have a third one against thirst?" I had a hard time breathing. My lungs were going to burst, empty kettles forgotten on the fire.
"You'll sleep. You won't be thirsty."
"I won't dream that I'm thirsty." The nurse lifted the covers.
"I'll give you a shot against dreams."
She's nice, I thought. Her heart is made of gold. She suffers when I suffer. She's quiet when I'm thirsty. She's quiet when I sleep. She's quiet when I dream. She's probably young, beautiful, beaming, attractive. She has a serious face, laughing eyes. She has a sensual mouth made for kissing, not for talking. Just like grandmother's eyes, which she used not for looking, not for wondering, but simply for crying. First shot, nothing. I didn't feel it. Second shot, this one in the arm, still nothing. I had so much pain that I couldn't even feel the injection. The nurse fixed the covers, put the needles in a metal box, moved a chair, and turned a switch.
"I'm putting out the light," she said. "You'll go to sleep soon."
All at once I got the idea that she too would want to kiss me before leaving. Just a little meaningless kiss on the forehead or on the cheek, and maybe even on the eyelids. They do that in hospitals. A good nurse kisses her patients when she says goodnight. Not on the mouth, on the forehead, on the cheeks. It reassures them. A patient thinks he is less ill if a woman wants to kiss him. He doesn't know that a nurse's mouth isn't made for speaking or even for crying, but for keeping quiet and for kissing patients so they can fall asleep without fear of the dark. Again I was completely covered with perspiration. "You mustn't kiss me," I whispered. The nurse laughed in a friendly way.
"Of course not. It makes you thirsty."
Then she left the room. And I waited to fall asleep.
'Tell me a little about yourself,' Kathleen said.
We were sitting in her room where it was pleasantly warm. We were listening to a Gregorian chant, which swelled inside us. The words and the music contained a peace that no storm could have disturbed. On a small table, our 2 cups were still half full. The coffee had become cold. The semi-darkness made me keep my eyes closed. The feeling of exhaustion that had been weighing me down at the beginning of the evening had completely disappeared. My nerves tense, I was conscious that time, as it passed through me, was carrying a part of me along with it.
"Tell me," Kathleen said. "I want to know you."
Her legs folded under her. She was sitting on my right on the beige couch. A dream was floating in the air, looking for a place on which to settle. "I don't feel like it," I answered. "I don't feel like talking about myself." To talk about myself, really talk about myself, I would have had to tell the story of my grandmother. I didn't feel like expressing it in words. grandmother could only be expressed in prayers. After the war, when I arrived in Paris, I had often, very often, been urged to tell. I refused. I told myself that the dead didn't need us to be heard. They are less bashful than I. Shame has no hold on them. While I was bashful and ashamed. That's the way it is. Shame tortures not the executioners, but their victims. The greatest shame is to have been chosen by destiny. Man prefers to blame himself for all possible sins and crimes rather than come to the conclusion that God is capable of the most flagrant injustice. I still blush every time I think of the way God makes fun of human beings, his favorite toys. Once I asked my teacher, Kalman the Kabbalist, the following question. For what purpose did God create man? I understand that man needs God. But what need of man has God? My teacher closed his eyes, and a thousand wounds, petrified arteries traveled by terror-stricken truths, drew a tangled labyrinth on his forehead. After a few minutes of contemplation, his lips formed a delicate, very distant smile. "The holy books teach us," he said, "that if man were conscious of his power, he would lose his faith or his reason. For man carries within him a role which transcends him. God needs him to be one. The Messiah, called to liberate man, can only be liberated by him. We know that not only man and the universe will be freed, but also the one who established their laws and their relations. It follows that man, who is nothing but a handful of earth, is capable of reuniting time and its source, and of giving back to God his own image." At the time, I was too young to understand the meaning of my teacher's words. The idea that God's existence could be bound to mine had filled me with a miserable pride as well as a deep pity. A few years later, I saw just, pious men walking to their death, singing, "We are going to break with our fire the chains of the Messiah in exile." That's when the symbolic implication of what my teacher had said struck me. Yes, God needs man. Condemned to eternal solitude, he made man only to use him as a toy, to amuse himself. That's what philosophers and poets have refused to admit. In the beginning, there was neither the word nor love, but laughter, the roaring, eternal laughter whose echoes are more deceitful than the mirages of the desert. "I want to know you," Kathleen said. Her face had darkened. The dream, finding no place to settle, had dissolved. I thought it could have entered her wide-open eyes. But dreams never enter from outside. "You might end up hating me," I told her. She drew her legs under her still more. Her whole body contracted, became smaller, as if it had wanted to follow the dream and disappear altogether. "I'll take a chance," she answered. "She'll hate me," I thought. "It's unavoidable. What happened will happen again. The same causes bring about the same effects, the same hatreds. Repetition is a decisive factor in the tragic aspect of our condition." I don't know the name of the first man who openly cried out his hatred to me, nor who he was. He represented all the nameless and faceless people who live in the universe of dead souls. I was on a French ship, sailing to South America. It was my first encounter with the sea. Most of the time I was on deck, studying the waves which untiringly dug graves only to fill them again. As a child I had searched for God because I imagined him great and powerful, immense and infinite. The sea gave me such an image. Now I understood Narcissus. He hadn't fallen into the fountain. He had jumped into it. At one point my desire to be one with the sea became so strong that I nearly jumped overboard. I had nothing to lose, nothing to regret. I wasn't bound to the world of men. All I had cared for had been dispersed by smoke. The little house with its cracked walls, where children and old men came humming to pray or study in the melancholy light of candles, was nothing but ruins. My teacher, who had been the first to teach me that life is a mystery, that beyond words there is silence, my teacher, whose head was always hanging as if he didn't dare face heaven, my teacher had long since been reduced to ashes. And my little sister, who made fun of me because I never played with her, because I was too serious, much too serious. My little sister no longer played. It was a stranger who, unknowingly, unwittingly, had prevented me from giving up that night. As I stood at the rail, he had come up behind me, I don't know from where, and had started talking to me. He was an Englishman. "Beautiful night," he said, leaning against the railing on my right, nearly touching me. "Very beautiful," I answered coldly. I thought, beautiful night for saying goodbye to cheaters, to the constants that become uncertainties, to ideals which imply treason, to the world where there is no longer room for what is human, to history that leads to the destruction of the soul instead of broadening its powers. The stranger wasn't intimidated by my ill humor. He continued, "The sky is so close to the sea that it is difficult to tell which is reflected in the other, which one needs the other, which one is dominating the other." "That's true," I again answered coldly. He stopped for a moment. I could see his profile, thin, sharp, noble. "If the two were at war," he went on, "I'd be on the side of the sea. The sky only inspires painters, not musicians. While the sea... Don't you feel that the sea comes close to man through its music?" "Perhaps," I answered with hostility. Again he stopped, as if wondering if he shouldn't leave me alone. He decided to stay. "Cigarette?" he asked, holding out his pack. "No, thanks, I don't feel like smoking." He lit his cigarette and threw the match overboard, a shooting star swallowed up by darkness. "They're dancing inside," he said. "Why don't you join them?" "I don't feel like dancing." "You prefer to be alone with the sea, don't you?" His voice had suddenly changed. It had become more personal, less anonymous. I wasn't aware that a man could change his voice as he would change a mask. "Yes, I prefer to remain alone with the sea," I answered nastily, stressing the word alone. He took a few puffs on his cigarette. "The sea. What does it make you think of?" I hesitated. The fact that he was shrouded in darkness, that I didn't know him, that I probably wouldn't even recognize him the next day in the dining room, worked in his favor. To talk to a stranger is like talking to stars. It doesn't commit you. "The sea," I said, "makes me think of death." I had the impression that he smiled.
"I knew it."
"How did you know?" I asked, disconcerted.
"The sea has a power of attraction. I'm 50, and have been traveling for 30 years. I know all the seas in the world. I know. One mustn't look at the waves for too long, especially at night. Especially alone.
He told me about his first trip. His wife was with him. They had just gotten married. One night he left his wife, who was sleeping, and went up on deck to get some air. There he became aware of the terrible power of the sea over those who see in it their transformed silhouette. He was happy and young, and yet he felt a nearly irresistible need to jump, to be carried away by the living waves whose roar, more than anything else, evokes eternity, peace, the infinite. "I'm telling you," he repeated very softly, "one mustn't look at the sea for too long. Not alone. And not at night." Then I, too, started telling him things about myself. Knowing that he had thought about death and was attracted by its secret, I felt closer to him. I told him what I had never told anyone. My childhood, my mystic dreams, my religious passions, my memories of German concentration camps, my belief that I was now just a messenger of the dead among the living. I talked for hours. He listened, leaning heavily on the railing, without interrupting me, without moving, without taking his eyes off a shadow that followed the ship. From time to time he would light a cigarette, and even when I stopped in the middle of a thought or a sentence, he said nothing. Sometimes I left a sentence unfinished, jumped from one episode to another, or described a character in a word without mentioning the event with which he was connected. The stranger didn't ask for explanations. At times I spoke very softly, so softly that it was impossible that he heard a word of what I was saying. But he remained motionless and silent. He seemed not to dare exist outside of silence. Only toward the end of the night did he recover his speech. His voice, a streak of shade, was hoarse. The voice of a man who, alone in the night, looks at the sea, looks at his own death. "You must know this," he finally said. "I think I'm going to hate you." Emotion made me gasp. I felt like shaking his hand to thank him. Few people would have had the courage to accompany me lucidly to the end. The stranger threw his head back as if to make sure that the sky was still there. Suddenly, he started hammering the railing with his clenched fist. And in a restrained, deep voice, he repeated the same words over and over. "I'm going to hate you. I'm going to hate you." Then he turned his back to me and walked off. A fringe of white light was brightening the horizon. The sea was quiet. The ship was dozing. The stars had started to disappear. It was daybreak. I stayed on deck all day. I came back to the same place the following night. The stranger never joined me again. "I'll take a chance," Kathleen said. I got up and took a few steps around the room to stretch my legs. I stopped at the window and looked out. The sidewalk across the street was covered with snow. A strange anguish came over me. Cold sweat covered my forehead. Once again the night would lift its burden, and it would be day. I was afraid of the day. At night I find all faces familiar. Every noise sounds like something already heard. During the day, I only run into strangers. "Do you know what Shimon Yanai told me about you?" Kathleen asked. "I have no idea."
What could he have told her? What does he know about me? Nothing.
He doesn't know that when I get carried away by a sunset, my heart fills with such nostalgia for Siget, the little town of my childhood, it begins to pound so hard, so fast, that a week later I still haven't caught my breath. He doesn't know that I'm more moved by a Hasidic melody, which brings man back to his origins, than by Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart together. He couldn't know that when I look at a woman, it's always the image of my grandmother that I see.
Shimonyanai thinks you're a saint, Kathleen said.
My answer was a loud, unrestrained laugh.
Shimonyanai says that you suffered a lot. Only saints suffer a lot.
I couldn't stop laughing. I turned toward Kathleen, toward her eyes, not made for seeing, nor for crying, but for speaking and perhaps for making people laugh. She was hiding her chin in the neck of her sweater, concealing her lips, which were trembling. Me, a saint? What a joke!
Why are you laughing?
I'm laughing, I answered, still shaking. I'm laughing because I'm not a saint. Saints don't laugh. Saints are dead. My grandmother was a saint. She's dead. My teacher was a saint. He's dead. But me, look at me, I'm alive. And I'm laughing. I'm alive and I'm laughing because I'm not a saint. At first I had a hard time getting used to the idea that I was alive. I thought of myself as dead. I couldn't eat, read, cry. I saw myself dead. I thought I was dead and that in a dream I imagined myself alive. I knew I no longer existed, that my real self had stayed there, that my present self had nothing in common with the other, the real one. I was like the skin shed by a snake. Then one day in the street, an old woman asked me to come up to her room. She was so old, so dried out, that I couldn't hold back my laughter. The old woman grew pale, and I thought she was going to collapse at my feet. "Haven't you any pity?" she said in a choked voice. Then, all of a sudden, reality struck me. I was alive, laughing, making fun of unhappy old women. I was able to humiliate and hurt old women who, like saints, spit on their own bodies. "Where does suffering lead to?" Kathleen asked tensely. "Not to saintliness?"
"No,"
I shouted. That stopped my laughter. I was getting angry. I walked away from the window and stood in front of her. She was sitting on the floor now, her arms around her knees and her head resting on her arms. "Those who say that are false prophets," I said. I had to make an effort not to scream, not to wake up the whole house and the dead who were waiting outside in the wind and the snow flurries. I went on. "Suffering brings out the lowest, the most cowardly in man. There is a phase of suffering you reach beyond which you become a brute. Beyond it, you sell your soul, and worse, the souls of your friends, for a piece of bread, for some warmth, for a moment of oblivion, of sleep. Saints are those who die before the end of the story. The others, those who live out their destiny, no longer dare look at themselves in the mirror, afraid they may see their inner image, a monster laughing at unhappy women, and at saints who are dead. Kathleen listened, in a daze, her eyes wide open. As I spoke, her back bent over even more. Her pale lips whispered the same sentence tirelessly. "Go on, I want to know more. Go on." Then I fell on my knees, took her head in my hands, and looking straight into her eyes, I told her the story of my grandmother, then the story of my little sister, and of my father, and of my mother. In very simple words, I described to her how man can become a grave for the unburied dead. I kept talking. In every detail I described the screams and the nightmares that haunt me at night. And Kathleen, very pale, her eyes red, continued to beg, "More, go on, more." She was saying more in the eager voice of a woman who wants her pleasure to last, who asks the man she loves not to stop, not to leave her, not to disappoint her, not to abandon her halfway between ecstasy and nothing.
More, more.
I kept looking at her and holding her. I wanted to get rid of all the filth that was in me, and graft it onto her pupils and her lips, which were so pure, so innocent, so beautiful. I bared my soul, my most contemptible thoughts and desires, my most painful betrayals, my vaguest lies. I tore them from inside me and placed them in front of her like an impure offering, so she could see them and smell their stench. But Kathleen was drinking in every one of my words as if she wanted to punish herself for not having suffered before. From time to time she insisted in the same eager voice that sounded so much like the old prostitute's, "More, more." Finally I stopped, exhausted. I stretched out on the carpet and closed my eyes. We didn't talk for a long time, an hour, perhaps two. I was out of breath. I was wet with perspiration. My shirt stuck to my body. Kathleen didn't stir. Outside, the night softly moved on. Suddenly we heard the noise of the milkman's truck coming from the street. The truck stopped near the door. Kathleen took a deep breath and said, "I feel like going down and kissing the milkman." I didn't answer. I didn't have the strength. "I would like to kiss him," Kathleen said, "just to thank him for being alive." I was silent. "You're not saying anything," she sounded surprised. "You're not laughing?" And as I still didn't say anything, she began to stroke my hair, then her fingers explored the outlines of my face. I liked the way she caressed me. "I like you to touch me," I told her, my eyes still closed. After hesitating, I added, "You see, it's the best proof that I'm not a saint. Saints, in that respect, are like the dead. They don't know desire." Kathleen's voice became lighter and sounded more provocative. "And you desire me?" "Yes." I again felt like laughing. A saint? Me? What a wonderful joke. Me, a saint. Does a saint feel this desire for a woman's body? Does he feel this need to take her into his arms, cover her with kisses, to bite her flesh, to possess her breath, her life, her breasts? No. A saint would not be willing to make love to a woman, with his dead grandmother watching, wearing her black shawl that seems to hold the nights and days of the universe. I sat down, and I said angrily, "I'm not a saint." "No?" Kathleen asked, without being able to smile. "No," I repeated. I opened my eyes and noticed that she was really suffering. She was biting her lips. There was despair in her face. "I'll prove to you that I'm not a saint," I muttered angrily. Without a word, I started to undress her. She didn't resist. When she was naked, she sat down again as before. Her head resting on her knees, she looked at me in anguish as I, too, undressed. Now there were two lines around her mouth. I could see fear in her eyes. I was pleased. She was afraid of me, and that was good. Those who, like me, have left their souls in hell are here only to frighten others by being their mirrors. "I am going to take you," I told her in a harsh, almost hostile voice, "but I don't love you." I thought, she must know. "I'm not a saint at all. I'll make love without any commitments. A saint commits his whole being with every act." She undid her hair, which fell to her shoulders. Her breast rose and fell irregularly. "What if I fall in love with you?" she asked with studied naivete. "Small chance. You'll hate me, rather." Her face became a little sadder, a little more distressed. "I'm afraid you're right." Somewhere above the city there was a hint of dawn in the foggy world. "Look at me," I said. "I'm looking at you." "What do you see?"
saint, she answered.
I laughed again.
There we were, both naked, and one of us was a saint. It was grotesque. I took her, brutally, trying to hurt her. She bit her lips and didn't cry out.
We stayed together until late that afternoon,
without saying another word,
without exchanging a kiss.
Suddenly the fever vanished. My name was taken off the critical list. I still had pain, but my life was no longer in danger. I was still given antibiotics, but less frequently. 4 shots a day, then 3, then 2, then none. When I was allowed visitors, I had been in the hospital for nearly a week, and in a cast for 3 days.
"Your friends may come to see you today," the nurse said as she washed me.
"Fine," I said.
"That's your only reaction? Aren't you pleased to be able to see your friends?"
"I am very pleased."
"You've come a long way," she said.
"A very long way."
"You're not talkative."
"No."
I had discovered one advantage in being ill. You can remain silent without having to apologize.
"After breakfast I'll come and shave you," the nurse said.
"It won't be necessary," I answered.
"Not necessary?"
She seemed not to believe me.
"Nothing that's done in a hospital is unnecessary."
"That's right, unnecessary. I want to grow a beard."
She stared at me a moment, then gave her verdict.
"No, you need a shave. You look too ill this way."
"But I am ill."
"You are, but if I shave you, you'll feel better."
And without giving me time to answer, she continued,
"You'll feel like new."
She was young, dark, obstinate. Tall, buttoned up in her white uniform, she towered over me, and not merely because she was standing up.
"All right," I said, to put an end to the discussion. "In that case, fine."
"Good, that's the boy."
She was happy with her victory, her mouth wide open, showing her white teeth. Laughingly, she began to tell me all kinds of stories which seemed to have the following moral: death is afraid to attack those who make themselves look nice in the morning. The secret of immortality may well be to find the right shaving cream.
After helping me wash, she brought my breakfast.
"I'll feed you as if you were a baby. Aren't you ashamed to be a baby at your age?"
She left and immediately returned with an electric razor.
"We want you to look nice. I want my baby to be nice."
The razor made a tremendous noise. The nurse went on chattering. I wasn't listening to her. I was thinking about the night of the accident. The cab was speeding. I had no idea it would send me to the hospital.
"There you are," the nurse said, beaming. "Now you're nice."
"I know," I said. "Now I'm like a newborn baby."
"Wait, and I'll bring you a mirror."
She had very large eyes, with black pupils, and the white around them was very white.
"I don't want it," I said.
"I'll bring it, you'll see."
"Listen," I said threateningly, "if you hand me a mirror, I'll break it. A broken mirror brings 7 years of unhappiness. Is that what you want? 7 years of unhappiness?"
For a second, her eyes were still, wondering if I wasn't joking.
"It's true. Anybody will tell you one should never break a mirror."
She was still laughing, but now her voice sounded more worried than before. She was wiping her hands on her white uniform.
"You're a bad boy," she said. "I don't like you."
"Too bad," I answered. "I adore you."
She muttered something to herself and left the room. I was facing the window and could see the East River from my bed. A small boat was going by, a grayish spot on a blue background, a mirage. Someone knocked at the door.
"Come in."
Dr. Paul Russell, hands in his pockets, was back to resume our conversation where we had left off.
"Feeling better this morning?"
Yes, doctor, much better. No more fever. The enemy is beaten.
A beaten enemy, that's dangerous, I remarked. He'll only think of vengeance.
The doctor became more serious. He took out a cigarette and offered it to me. I refused. He lit it for himself.
Do you still have pain?
Yes.
It'll last a few weeks more. You're not afraid?
Of what?
Of suffering?
No, I'm not afraid of suffering.
He looked me straight in the eye.
What are you afraid of, then?
Again, I had the impression that he was keeping something from me. Could he actually know? Had I talked in my sleep during the operation?
I'm not afraid of anything, I answered, staring back at him.
There was a silence.
He went to the window and stayed there a few moments.
There, I thought, the back of a man, and the river no longer exists.
Paradise is when nothing comes between the eye and the tree.
You have a beautiful view, he said without turning.
Very beautiful. The river is like me. It hardly moves.
Sheer illusion. It's calm only on the surface. Go beneath the surface, you'll see how restless it is.
He turned suddenly.
Just like you, as a matter of fact.
What does he know exactly? I wondered, somewhat worried. He speaks as if he knows. Is it possible that I betrayed myself?
Every man is like the river, I said, to shift the conversation toward abstractions. Rivers flow toward the sea, which is never full. Men are swallowed up by death, which is never satiated.
He made a gesture of discouragement, as if to say, All right, you don't want to talk, you're dodging, it doesn't matter, I'll wait. Slowly he moved toward the door, then stopped.
I have a message for you, from Kathleen. She's coming to see you in the late afternoon.
You saw her?
Yes, she's been coming every day. She's an extremely nice girl.
Extremely.
He was standing in the opening of the door. His voice seemed very close. The door must have been right next to my bed.
She loves you, he said.
His voice became hard, insistent. And you? Do you love her?
He stressed the you.
I was breathing faster. What does he know? I asked myself, tormented.
Of course, I answered, trying to look calm. Of course I love her.
Nothing stirred. There was complete silence. In the hallway, the foggy loudspeaker announced, Dr. Brownstein, telephone, Dr. Brownstein, telephone.
Echoes from another world. In the room, there was utter silence.
Fine, Dr. Russell said. I have to go. I'll see you tonight or tomorrow.
Another boat was gliding by the window. Outside, the air was sharp, alive. I thought, at this very moment, men are walking in the streets without ties, in their shirt sleeves. They are reading, arguing, eating, drinking, stopping to avoid a car, to admire a woman, to look at windows. Outside, at this very moment, men are walking.
Toward the beginning of the afternoon, some of my colleagues showed up. They came together, gay and trying to make me feel equally gay. They told me some gossip, who was doing what, who was saying what, who was unfaithful to whom. The latest word, the latest indiscretion, the latest story. Then the conversation came back to the accident.
You must admit you've been lucky. This could have been it, one of them said.
And another, or you could have lost a leg.
Or even your mind.
You're going to be rich, Sandor, a Hungarian, said. I was hit by a car once myself. I got $1,000 from the insurance company. You were lucky it was a cab. Cab always have a lot of insurance. You'll be rich. You'll see, you lucky bastard.
I hurt everywhere. I couldn't move. I was practically paralyzed. But I was very lucky. I was going to be rich. I'd be able to travel, go to nightclubs, keep mistresses, be on top of the world. What luck! They just about said they envied me. "I'd always been told that in America you find dollars in the street," I said. "So it's true. You just have to fall down to pick them up." They laughed still more, and I laughed with them. Once or twice the nurse came in to bring me something to drink, and she also laughed with them. "And you know, this morning he didn't even want to shave," she told them. "He's rich," Sandor said. "Rich men can afford to be unshaven." "You're funny," the nurse exclaimed, clapping her hands. "And did he tell you about the mirror?" "No," they all shouted together. "Tell us about the mirror." She told them that I had refused to look at myself in the mirror that morning. "Rich men are afraid of mirrors," I said. "Mirrors have no respect for that which glitters. They're too familiar with it." It was warm in the room, even warmer than in the cast. My friends were perspiring. The nurse was wiping her forehead with the back of her hand. When she left, Sandor winked. "Not bad, huh?" "She must be something," another added. "Well, you won't get bored here, you can be sure of that much." "No, I won't get bored," I said. We had been together for quite some time when Sandor remembered that there was a press conference at 4. "That's true, we'd forgotten." They left in a hurry, taking their laughter with them into the hallway, into the street, and finally, where it assumes an historic function, into the United Nations building. It was nearly 7 when Kathleen arrived. She seemed paler than usual, and gayer, also more exuberant. It was as if she were living the happiest moments of her life. "What a beautiful view! Look, the river, and such a nice room! So big, so clean, you're looking great!" "It's weird," I thought. "A hospital room is the gayest place on earth. Everybody turns into an actor, even the patients. You put on new attitudes, new makeup, new joys." Kathleen kept talking. Even though she didn't like people who talk without saying anything, she was doing precisely that now. Why is she afraid of silence? I wondered as I grew more tense. Is it possible she knows something, too? She's in a position to know. She was there at the time of the accident, a little ahead. She may have turned around. I would have liked to steer the conversation to that subject, but I couldn't stop the flow of her words. She kept talking and talking. "Isak is replacing you on the paper. In the office, the phone keeps ringing, all kinds of people asking how you are, and you know, even the one, what's his name, you know the one I mean, the fat one, the one who looks pregnant, you know, the one who's angry at you, even he called. Isak told me, and..." There was a knock on the door. A nurse, a new one, not the morning nurse, brought in my dinner. She was an old woman with glasses, haughtily indifferent. She offered to help me eat. "Don't bother," Kathleen said. "I'll do it." "Very well," the old nurse said. "As you wish." I wasn't hungry. Kathleen kept insisting. "Some soup?" "Yes. Yes, you have to. You've lost a lot of strength. Come on, just one spoonful, just one. One more. Do it for me. And one more. Fine. And now the rest. Let's see. A piece of meat. Ah, does that look good?" I closed my eyes and tried not to hear. That was the only way. I suddenly felt like shouting, but I knew I shouldn't. Anyway, what would have been the use? Kathleen talked on and on. "I also retained a lawyer, a very good one. He's going to sue the cab company. He'll be here tomorrow. He's very hopeful. He says you'll get a lot of money." When I was through eating, she took the tray and put it on the table. I could see as she busied herself how tired she was. Now I understood why she was talking so much. She was at the end of her strength. Behind her forced good humor was exhaustion. 7 days. It had been a week since the accident. "Kathleen," I called.
"Yes?"
"Come here, sit down." She obeyed and sat on the bed. "What is it?" she asked, worried. "I want to ask you something." She frowned. Yes?
I don't recognize you. You've changed. You talk a lot. Why? A shudder went through her eyelids, through her shoulders.
So many things have happened in a week, she said, blushing slightly. I want to tell you about them. Everything. Don't forget that I haven't talked to you in a week.
She looked at me as if she had been beaten, and lowered her head.
Then, slowly, mechanically, she repeated several times, in a low, tired, toneless voice,
I don't want to cry. I don't want to cry. I don't want...
Poor Kathleen, I thought.
Poor Kathleen. I have changed her. Kathleen, so proud. Kathleen, whose will was stronger than others. Kathleen, whose strength was pure and who was truly tough. Kathleen, against whom men with character, strong-minded men, liked to pit themselves. Now Kathleen didn't even have the strength to hold back her tears, her words. I had transformed her, and she had wanted to change me. You can't change a human being, I had told her in the beginning, once, a thousand times. You can change someone's thoughts, someone's attitudes, someone's ties. You might even change someone's desires, but that's all.
That's enough for me, she had answered. And the battle had started. She wanted to make me happy, no matter what. To make me taste the pleasures of life, to make me forget the past.
Your past is dead. Dead and buried, she would say, and I would answer, I am my past. If it's buried, I'm buried with it.
She was fighting stubbornly. I'm strong, she would say. I'll win. And I would answer, you are strong. You are beautiful. You have all the qualities to conquer the living. But here you are fighting the dead. You cannot conquer the dead.
We shall see.
I don't want to cry, she said, her head down as if under the weight of all the dead since creation.
I had said human beings don't change. I was wrong. They do. The dead are all-powerful. That's what she refused to understand, that the dead are invincible, that through me she was fighting them. The only child of very rich parents, she was determined and obstinate. Her arrogance was almost naive. She wasn't accustomed to losing battles. She thought she could take the place of my fate.
Once I had asked her if she loved me.
No, she had answered heatedly.
And it was true. She hadn't lied. The truly proud don't lie.
Our understanding had nothing to do with love, not at first. Later, yes, but not at the beginning. What united us was exactly what kept us apart. She liked life and love. I only thought of life and love with a strong feeling of shame. We stayed together. She needed to fight, and I was watching her. I watched her knocking against the cold, unchanging reality she had discovered first in my words, then in my silence. We traveled a lot. The days were full, the hours dense. Time was once more an adventure. Whenever Kathleen watched a beautiful dawn, she knew how to make me share her enthusiasm. In the street, she was the one to point out beautiful women. At home, she taught me that the body is also a source of joy. At first, at the very beginning, I avoided her kisses. We were living together, but our mouths had never met. Something in me shrank from the touch of her lips. It was as if I were afraid that she would become different if I kissed her. Several times she had nearly asked me why, but she had been too proud. Then, little by little, I let myself go. Every kiss reopened an old wound, and I was aware that I was still capable of suffering, that I was still answering the calls of the past. Our affair lasted a whole year. When we celebrated the first anniversary of our meeting, that's what we liked to call our affair,
we both decided to separate. Since the experiment had foundered, there was no reason to draw it out. That night neither one of us slept. Stretched out next to each other, frightened, in silence, we waited for daybreak. Just before dawn, she pulled me toward her, and in the dark, our bodies made love for the last time. An hour later, still silent, I got up, dressed, and left the room without saying goodbye, without even turning around. Outside, the biting morning wind whipped the houses. The streets were still deserted. Somewhere a door creaked. A window lit up, lonely and pale. It was cold. My legs would have liked me to run. I managed to walk slowly, very slowly. I didn't want to give in to any weakness. My eyes were crying, probably because of the cold. "I don't want to cry," Kathleen said. She was shaking her lowered head. "Poor Kathleen," I thought. "You too have been changed by the dead." The lawyer came the next day. He wore glasses, was of medium height, and had the self-satisfied air of someone who knows the answer before he has even asked you the question. He introduced himself, Mark Brown. "Call me Mark." He sat down as if he were at home and took a large yellow pad out of his briefcase. "I talked to your doctors," he said. "You were in very bad shape. That's very good." "You're right. That's very good." He understood the irony. "Of course, I'm only speaking from the point of view of the lawsuit," he said, winking at me. "So am I," I answered. "I hear you're going to make me rich."
"I have high hopes."
"Be careful. My enemies will never forgive me. I'm about to become a rich journalist." He laughed.
"For once, the law will be on the side of literature."
He started asking me detailed questions. What exactly had happened on the night of the accident? Had I been alone? No. Who was with me? Kathleen. Yes, the young woman who had called him. Had we quarreled? No. Had we waited for the light to turn green before crossing the street? Yes. The cab had come from the left. Had I seen it approaching? I took a little more time to answer this last question. Mark took off his glasses, and as he wiped them, he repeated,
"Did you see it approaching?"
"No," I said. He looked at me more sharply.
"You seem to hesitate."
"I'm trying to relive the incident, to see it again." Mark was in